Now here we have Urs Malin, April 12, 2003, Persona, a workshop, tape 1 of 2.
It was almost something like synonymous of accepting himself. He seeks to be cured first by one doctor and then by another, now by such and such a method or in such and such circumstances, irrespective of any serious cooperation on his own part. Now, no one can be washed without getting wet, without the most perfect goodwill and the absolutely serious intention of the patient, no recovery is possible. That's one thing, but then it crossed my mind also, especially with what you have said, you're working with anorectic patients, maybe, or I wouldn't say probably, women are more apt for that word. Women are better apt for that word. And you also, and we discussed this morning, you have to have inner affinity to eating disorders in order to treat them. Now, I'm afraid I love too much to eat and I love too much to cook, so I can't understand it. I mean, we talk of persona of the week.
Sorry?
I mean,
that's my eating disorder, loving too much to eat.
Okay, now that's good news of this morning, so I dare treat him. Yeah, I said, well, I like to eat. yes. Yeah, we had an example of that yesterday. We did it. I was actually sympathetic with you. You're eating these small almonds, and I said, "Well, better some small almonds than no beer." No, we
take a break.
Of course, yep. Yes, please. Yes.
And it seems to me there were some transitional images between the sort of the everyday appearance and the demonic.
Yeah.
There were some transitional ones.
Absolutely.
First encounter I had with the cyclopon.
Oh. Yeah.
And so it's an animus type of a character which has this, you know, reptilian scale or whatever, you know, sort of it's not demonic though, but it had some of these characteristics. And what it seemed to me with the women who were not willing to go inward, were not willing to deal with this inner world, that by rejecting that archetype in their life, it became hostile to them. Mm-hmm. And by becoming hostile, there became this polarization to, and that's what forced it into this more demonic form. And so these women are unwilling to, as you said, in and out, this bulimic reaction, unwilling to go in and relate to this that has been activated in their psyche. These, you said, these are intelligent women, very intelligent women. This they have the capacity, and it's been activated, but they aren't willing to empathize with it and to follow and trust that part and go inward with it, and therefore this hostility comes back from it, and then it turns into this demonic force which is so destructive and eats them up.
Thank you very much. Now, I think diagnosis is absolutely as you say. Now, what would be the possibility of therapeutic intervention with that state between which you name, I think, and you're completely right, Chico Pompos, one who leads you. Mm-hmm. But how can you actual will connect with that piece of
stuff. And that's I'm not a therapist, so I don't really know how you would deal with that. I just know from my own experience that the first time I encountered this, it wasn't in it. There was no context of possibility. There was a context of trust and empathy. Yeah. So it never arose as a problem for me. I don't know if these women, being as intelligent as they are, if an intellectual explanation of what this is might be possible or not. Or,
Can I make a request?
Yeah.
Could we perhaps show those last two transparencies again? I think it would be helpful to see the pictures. Can we do that again? Yeah.
You want to see all of them again?
Well, just
the two women.
Since we're spending a lot of time on them, it would be nice to sort of refresh.
Yeah, but all the transparent the whole theory. Well, you know.
Would that be okay?
This is in first, and then with that, what you refer to probably getting up in that transitional state. Would you see that as still the transition?
Well, it was more clear to me in the second.
Second, yeah.
In
but
the second
let
patient.
Me just for those who haven't seen it, show me the eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this one. So that's the first one that I worked with. And then it really looks like a modern painting.
Yes.
Absolutely.
It looks like a Matisse.
Yeah, a little bit, yes. Only he preferred not unrighted
very
well. Right. Inside, it's like an early Matisse, absolutely. And here she shows her the place where she wanted to change her body. We were too fat for her. And then now we have that problem.
And this is the one that I'm thinking
this
of.
One.
This one is not as frightening to me as a transitional man as in the first patient.
Yeah.
But then, of course, it becomes more frightening.
Yeah. But that's to me absolutely archetypal.
Yeah.
And here we have that snake witch like. And here we have that absolute desperation.
They're suffering from the same disorder, but they seem to be very different.
How would you say that?
Well, their ego, I'm not a therapist, I don't know the terminology.
No, describe it.
The first woman seems to be the need to control and really kind of put off by the outsider. She wants to be who she is in the out, and she doesn't care much about the outside world.
But, yeah.
But the other woman strikes me as almost being destroyed by the outside world. She can't cope. The other woman seems to be coping, but might destroy herself in the process.
Yeah.
The other woman seems not to. I mean, that last picture is just
devastating. Absolutely. Well, the second woman, though, with the snake, which is interesting. I mean, it might be sort of an attempt to destroy others.
It's, and unfortunately, as I told you, I'm not familiar, very familiar with the second one. since I was interested in the series and it's been a case which I controlled but years ago, so I know less about her, unfortunately, as I am quite new in the first one. But I think that there's one which I just found.
You asked the question earlier that I want to respond to in relationship to the second person.
Yes.
Which was, you used the word cure. I'm not a therapist, so I'm not going to suggest the cure, but I guess the way I see it is you need to create a safe place, or that person, the patient, needs to feel that they're in a safe place where they can start to interact with that, is what I would.
Absolutely.
And in terms of the second person, I definitely see a distinct personality difference. The second person I identify with more. She had a more a kinder, more open sort of feeling. And the snake, I actually didn't like that image, but rather than thinking in terms of that as being an evil symbol, if you thought of that in terms of going down into the reptilian levels and being in touch with it, and not seeing the snake, of course, tongue is a negative thing, it could also be her ability to really get down in there.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Thank you very much.
I wanted to respond to what you said. I think with very intellectual women that the place to meet them is with thinking or with some structure, with some theory, or something that connects for them and makes it feel safe enough to start in the process. And back to what you said earlier about women and men and working on this problem, you talked about the pride that women showed when they came in to talk about having courage.
Yeah.
And what I experienced is the shame. So I wonder if there's a different face that gets shown to a man and to a woman. And it's sort of like these images could all be the same person too, because given that we're all always in process, we all have many different parts. It's not like they're different people.
But I saw that in the first series, I saw more of the transition towards the satanic, you know, with the horns and all that. And I think of the European idea of the satanic as a reflection of having turned the relationship to the spiritual world over to the priest, and the ordinary person is not supposed to go into those levels, into those psychological levels, and therefore that has become, you know, becomes hostile. And the more you reject going into those levels, the more it responds with the hostility. And it becomes so that demonic with the horns and everything. And the second woman didn't seem to have that degree of overlay of Satan on the... It was more of a feminine, the dark goddess aspect.
But it could be a sequential thing, because in the eyes of the culture, to really go into the feminine looks like Satan to some people. It's the patriarchal eye.
True.
You know, to really go into the feminine is a very courageous thing to do. And it looks like satanic stuff sometimes.
But, you know, it seems to me that fits with what you have said, because the last picture of the second one is really despair. That's shame. That's whereas that, you know, as it is with Satan, it has that also that I would almost say playful expeditionistic aspect, which is you can't imagine how much I ate. So to admit shame is a very good basis for building up. Whereas that exhibitionism, look, whatever I am, and look how much I admire, in a way, what I could eat, you wouldn't believe it. That's persona, on a very, very deep level. But it's not admitting shame and suffering. It has that aspect as well. You know? Because as soon as somebody is able to exteriorize by expressing drawings, there is always also a certain distance, which is healthy and necessary, but you never can exclude some exhibitionistic aspect. Yeah. So thank you very much. It's very well.
There's
seem to be quite passive. And it's only getting into the demonic that they can
They are almost like models, actually.
Which we will talk about.
Passive and okay.
If there's a seance, maybe it's a conscious inflation.
Okay, it can be useful to ask people sometimes whether they're bragging or complaining. They're not mutually exclusive. Whether someone's reciting a symptom complex, you can ask, are you bragging or complaining?
Yeah. It would be a little bit hard.
I wasn't thinking of these patients particularly, but just people in general. They're doing both.
Absolutely.
But he said, would you do it? Would you ask?
I don't know.
It depends.
But I have another comment about what I call the series. The first one, and the punchline. The first one, for me, the profile view, I would call that a serious drawing. So it's a little bit of a comic book thing, but it's still serious.
Yep.
But the last frontal shot is like, if I were the instructor, I would tell her, go back and redo that thing. You're all into it. So she ends up with a joke.
Yeah.
Punchline. And the last one with the in the cave, that was not a joke. That was a poetry. So the two people have different, they end up in a different place.
That's interesting. I like that approach very much, and sometimes in music unions therapy they do apply artistic criteria. I think that's very important. Sometimes we are happy if people can just draw something, and these really criteria, is it more that or that in direction, that gives us help to understand the person better. Very much. Are there other comments or questions or contributions to that? Now, there was a second thing which I was, the question which was asked and which I answered a little bit too much from the outside on, the question of grief, what is grief? And persona would have to do, and I said what one would really need in a situation of loss, of despair, of experiences, chaos. So anything else but persona from the other person. But I thought I did not focus on the attitude which a person in such a situation herself could do. And well, Goethe has written in once, in case of a great loss of something, one should always think what is still left. And that's probably if we put it in our terms, putting the accent of the regressive restoration of the persona, but which is necessary. So I think collective rituals to grieve help. Whereas we don't have them anymore. No, very often people would expect, you have that now. As soon as possible, back to business as usual. Whereas the period of grief, which would be collectively ruled, would help the person confronted with such a, in such a situation to go through that period of grief. Whereas we don't have that anymore. No, it's something. Yeah.
Just to emphasize the point, as a minister, my colleagues and I are talking about how relatively fewer people even have funerals.
Yeah.
So it's not, it it's not even that there's no acknowledgement and let's rush on. No. It's that when grandmother dies, there's nothing. There's no place, there's no acknowledgement, there's no service, there is nothing. And I go into homes and find that what then happens is that the ashes are often above the mantelpiece. So I just thought that was interesting.
There's a nice contrast to that in the Japanese Buddhist temple world, that you have not only the funeral, but you have something at 49 days, mm-hmm. at 6 months, at a year, yeah. at 2 years, at 3 years, and then the intervals get greater and greater, but you have 10 years, you have the intervals. That's gradually, right. yeah. gradually spread out, but you have another surface on each of those occasions.
The intermediate step is that back east there's a much higher proportion of burials of body. And out here there's a much higher proportion of cremation. And so there seems to be this, it's almost like a stepping away from the reality of incarnation. It's not the body just got out of the meat.
Well, a lot of people will prefer, I mean, this is getting off your point, but prefer cremation because they see that as a more spiritual way of reintegrating.
That fits very much in with what I think I'm saying. But I agree with you. I mean, the American funeral industry has done strange things and take money, but there is a stepping back from the old ritual, a stepping away from the old ritual.
I'm trying to take this back to, I'm going to acknowledge my, and I'm still struggling with what is the persona. I mean, in each of these examples. And so I think what I'm hearing you say is that there's a link between collectively recognized rituals which provide a role that you fit into that then becomes your persona for that experience, your way of being able to interact.
Okay.
And sometimes when I'm working with, I'm thinking of a woman who is always that feeling, why aren't I over it yet? You know, and sometimes the image will come to me of, well, this was the 1800s, you'd be dressed in black for a year. And on one hand, that's maybe oppressive, but on the other hand, it kind of identifies you as somebody who still has the right to be in mourning.
Yeah. Exactly. And as you said, you know, I had that feeling. But that's quite often the last word of the last word of somebody. And in my opinion, you know, it's actually two ways. You want to decide what happens, and no collective thing. I don't want to be. And that, you know, the tendency of really taking control over everything. It's something with Chinese big shadows. And I don't know whether we have that in the States, but I'm very ambivalent with that. We have in Europe these movements, exit, where you can, you really can decide when you want to die under certain conditions. And somebody comes and brings you poison and things are taken care of. And to me, it's really that enormous tendency having control over everything. And then when the ego is finished, nothing. And it's the denying of, you know, I think your question is very, what is the persona? Mm-hmm. The persona can be different things, but in these issues, it's your help to go through very important stages of transition. Mm-hmm. And that's why, it's an 18th century born that. But that's not so much right. When I remember when my father died in 1954, it was the person who had a black button. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's completely unfulfilling. Well, it's not, no sign of mourning anymore. Mm-hmm.
No sign of mourning.
No,
it's interesting because this wearing black, if you've had a loss, you're drawn to black. Mm-hmm. You don't want, nothing else feels right. And sometimes it goes on far more than a year, mm-hmm. having been there myself. But the word widow has the same root as the word originate. And there's certainly that whatever persona is. I mean, yeah. The black coloring says.
Yeah. Perhaps the black is also a way of giving more social license to someone in that situation. It becomes its own persona. And it says this person may act a little crazy, but there's a reason to scare them up for it.
But what confuses me about this discussion is that it seems as if you can discuss it either on the outside or on the inside. And you're discussing it on the outside. What it appears on the outside. I guess my question is, to what degree is it transformational on the inside, and when is it successful, and when, you know, what is the process internally? These are manifestations of the society may or may not have, and to the degree that they may be helpful, I don't know. But to what degree is grief transformation, and why is that? I think what you were individuation maybe, but it seems like if that were understood a little better, maybe we would be better able. I have a good friend and I'm struggling, and I don't know what to do.
That's a since we are discussing it from the outside, it's compatible with our human persona. Now, I think the outside from us like a head or shell, and that, in my personal conviction, what's inside is personal and is a secret, and cannot be generalized. And no, that's, again, you know, there are some books and divided different phases of grief. I don't think it's not at all, because it's individual. It can be very different. It can be nothing at all, and then suddenly you fall into something. Or it can be neutral. And I would, you know, I have a little bit the fear that trying to generalize it, you're pressed into a form where yourself are confronted with your individuality. And I don't think you have to go through the phases, but then everything is okay again. It might not. The phase may arrive, may not. But even you know, in I don't think so much about therapy, but about friendship and that's what I tried to say yesterday. Be with, and let somebody have secret. Because we all have to go for it.
Well, when you use the phrase regressive restoration of persona, and then you also use the phrase a little bit earlier, put the accent on what is left. Mm-hmm. I'm not clear what you meant. What I thought I was hearing was by being with the person, friend, or whatever, and putting an emphasis on the aspects of persona that have not been lost. If, for example, it's someone who's lost a child or lost a husband, then their persona in respect of being a mother or being a father or being a spouse has been lost. But what's left is some aspect of that persona or some other aspects of their persona. Is that what you mean by putting emphasis on what is left?
I think that's going much over the persona issue. Because the danger, and there we have some sort of a parallel with these cases, in the case of a loss, is the feeling of complete annihilation and chaos. And persona might be a part of it, friends are an important part of it, but also what resources, what, and not to the least, what tasks are left for you. A mother may have lost her child, but must not lose her capacity of mothering. I see it on that level. Because, you know, I quoted briefly that example yesterday of that young man whose girlfriend was not feeling the same way. And he was really confronted with that. It's no worth to life anymore. A moment. And then when you try to be with that situation and to understand it, there is an enormous amount of gratefulness because you connect the person who is confronted with the chaos with possibilities. That's the attitude you take as a friend or as a therapist. There's no difference at all.
So the persona as a mask or as conventionality, at this point in time, in grief, can be a protective container.
Yes.
So that the outside behavior, the outside persona, what you're showing the world, doing bad, can actually affect the inner. It's not just that the outer is a sign of what's going on inside. It's the outside, in its very conventionality and ritual, can affect the inside and protect it. My sense is that our culture has been exposed to so much superficial ritual. Ritual has a bad name. But I find ritual, when done somehow organically, is intensely emotional. And that the early Greek theater, precisely because of the mass, was able to convey incredible intensity.
Yes.
And I think we saw it in the Mayan.
Yeah.
And what we saw there was incredible. But if it had not had the ritual container and protector and shaker,
yes,
it would not have been either art or profound.
Yeah.
And that's precisely the sense we've lost. So when you see somebody in grief, we say, oh, I just don't want to say the conventional thing.
Yeah.
Well, but perhaps if done with integrity, that would help.
Yeah. Okay. These are the two aspects which came to me, which I thought we had to come back to. Are there other, concerning these two aspects, other additional questions?
I just throw in a thought about the mask. The persona comes from parasomare, which is to sound through. And so it's, as Jim said, as you said, that it conceals, but it also expresses.
Right.
So the mask represented the role. Major role, and I think even had a kind of a megaphone quality, so it helped the actor project the character out to the audience. So it's always important to remember it's not necessarily false or phony, it's
no.
Like the text, but no. Also expresses.
Yeah.
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 Back to what I defined at the beginning yesterday. Persona makes the connection between the person and the outside world. Whereas the ego also has a full mediation of animus and anima connected to the inside world. So it's very not only risky but dangerous if the ego identifies itself with the persona. Then we come to what is what would be called in theory of Gnosticism to the false self. Because then the connection to the self is broken. Whereas, I like that phrase very much by Neumann, or that expression, the ego-self axis. Which connects that inner that inner tie with the core of the personality and also with the totality of the personality Jung calls the self. Whereas the persona helps us to find our way in society. So it's absolutely not identical. And the more it gets identical, the more it goes in the direction towards the false self.
And the ego becomes gains a capacity to choose to have access to various persona,
yeah,
various masks,
yeah.
And gets,
yeah.
It absolutely. Different situations, yeah. Which one where.
Yeah.
And it's the ego that can make that choice. Yeah. But it's not uncommon for people to identify with
that. That's completely true. You know, yesterday, Kali told me after lecture, something was really shocking. But you have a very different persona when you lecture than when you are. I thought, different ways of dealing with those situations. But you know, I think it's important to, it can be described in terms of persona according to your situation, to adapt persona-wise to the social situation.
Yes, and the biggest problem comes when people say, "Oh, I'm just going to be myself."
Oh yes, Oh yeah, exactly. Terrible. That's
And it's a situation where being your most vulnerable self is inappropriate. Well, then the consequences.
You started out the lecture by saying that the persona is an archetype, and I don't understand what that is, because I think of the persona more as an adaptation to learn how to live in the world.
That's what we also tonight. Is it really an archetype or not? And I came to the happy conclusion it was an archetype, because first, archetype is never really defined by anyone. Second, when you see archetype as something, as a center of every human being is confronted with, it's an archetype.
Mm-hmm.
Only on other different things. We all have to deal, even Robinson Crusoe, after Freitag came and he had a persona. It's a funny thing. Robinson Crusoe was the only man who got everything done by Friday. the persona too.
I was just going to add to this conversation about the need for a persona, and some people's sense that they shouldn't have one, that's false. I'm a dean at North Seattle Community College, and just a couple of weeks ago I was working with a young English teacher and talking with her about, she doesn't give a sense that she knows what she's doing in the classroom, and so the students tend not to trust her. It's not that they shouldn't, but that she, and I was talking about the need to, be there, and you know this, and not just kind of waver all the time and change your mind. And she said, "Well, you mean I have to be something other than how I feel?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm so
professional."
Exactly. I said, part of the, some of us have talked about being a teacher in a way, you write your own character and then you learn to act that character in the classroom. And yes, it comes from some true places in you, but it's one of those
for
something that we get put on
sometimes. Absolutely. When I was training teachers, I came to, people I really like to quote themselves. I quote myself to that. The possibility of school depends on the great error of one is stronger than 20. One person is never stronger than 20. So you have to, and I give the example of dompteur, not the one in the circus.
Lion tamer,
yeah. If the lion tamer would say to the lions, "Well, my dear lions, what are we going to do?" They would know what to do. The famous last word of the new teacher: "Children, I'm the new teacher." one really has to, and to adapt one's personality to the social situation. And I would have come back to that after, but I can put now. The animist has to have a big part of the persona. We hear things which, if we did react normally to them, would be highly inadequate. For instance, I had a man who was doing supervision with me, who treated a woman who used to cut her belly. Now, if you react normally, well, never do such a terrible thing again, what do you think? And that's not an answer. We have to, in that case, realize to our persona and so on. Because we would be absolute acting in a very inadequate way. There's a French movie, Fantomas, very funny. And there's a scene where in an old castle, and a police inspector, because the other one has found a person who hung herself up in a cupboard. And the reaction of the other inspector, what a terrible thing! And now no policeman would react like that. Mm-hmm. So the professional persona is part of our test. And if you can't get it, it becomes very clear in teaching profession. You have to have that certain possibility of an extroversion which is convincing.
I like to throw in a young story of that. This came to me from Bill Alex, who got the first diploma from the Zurich Institute. And it was about his friend Dave Dunn, who was also from Los Angeles and studied at that time. And one day was on his way to his hour with Jung, and on the way he met, I think it was Mary Footman, coming from her time with Jung, and he said to Mary, Mary, some of us are going sailing on the Zurich Sea tomorrow afternoon. Would you care to join us? And Mary said, oh, thank you very much. I'll have to see what my dream says. They went on to Jung, and this was on his mind, so he told Jung what had just happened. And Jung said, well, if someone extended an invitation like that to you, how would you respond? And she said, well, either I'd say, thank you very much, I'd be delighted, or I'm sorry, I have a conflict, I can't, or I'm not sure, I'll go home and look at my calendar and call you this afternoon. And Jung said, ah, you see, you are fit for life.
Very good story.
It can be a Jungian hazard to put our total trust in the other.
No.
So how would you interpret this, you know, Rudolf Steiner of the Waldorf schools, he said that the children will teach the teacher how to teach. Now, I can't quite remember, or maybe I never did know what he exactly meant by that, but I feel that there has to, that maybe the teacher needs some humility, you know, in connection with his persona. The persona sounds to me very confident or whatever, but that, don't you have to be careful with that too?
You know, I would see it differently. It's exactly the persona which allows you, it's in that case comparable with what we talked about briefing. The persona provides you the shell that you can open, and open to the process, in that case of teaching, which has to go outward. Whereas if you, I heard once of a young teacher who was having the fantasy of children running against him and aggressing him. So he wasn't able to learn from them. Whereas if you have that persona, if you are protected by the persona, only then you are open to learn from them. That's the
thing.
It's again, you know, that what we encounter very often, the paradox of holding attention instead of relying on one or the other. It means both, absolutely both. If you are, if the ego is identified with the persona, then you are not able to communicate.
Yeah.
Then you can put a show and children
whatever.
And sometimes that happens with teachers. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So
then
they're nothing but teachers.
If I can, I'm a part-time teacher, so I have some part-time teacher. So you can think of
part-time yourself.
I think how that translates for me is you have to have your lesson. You have to know what you're doing. But each class is different. But when you start the class, you have to do it your way to settle the class, right? Then you have to listen. Then you assess the class and you respond, but you don't give them the control. You're listening, you're responding, but it's still your plan.
One time I came into a classroom in East Germany shortly after the wall came down. And, well, it was the 1st of April, so that's different. But they had a condom filled with water stuck on the board. And I guess I had my persona available because I seemed to deal with it easily. I just...
It was in the service of not being confronted with the wound which lay behind. So, you could almost take that symbolically. Gaining weight was a protection from being too much exposed. But she fixed herself on the problem was the gaining weight. Now, you see that what I addressed yesterday, how it's difficult to correct that on the level where it's experienced. Her uncle once, as a compliment, said to herself so that he would dislike thin woman. Reaction was gives him more complex. Not the persona is the problem, but the defense against pain and sorrow, which is covered by the persona, which by that seemingly becomes the problem. And you know, if you said, well, like to the first woman I told you, and I showed you the pictures, you are beautiful, they don't believe it. When the uncle says, I don't like thin women, oh, he wants to say, I'm too thick. It's all in the in the direction of that shame, but the symptom, the symptom of the shame, or the so-called biggest problem, as well as the forming of the symptoms, are both defenses against the much deeper wound of that loss. Now, as I said, just to come back, not only the analysis, but we as analysts have a persona too. And as a matter of fact, and I like that saying of Winnicott, analysis can be compared to a play or can be seen as an overlapping of two playgrounds. Now, our rules of play considerably differ from, for instance, psychoanalytic rules. Accordingly, the persona of the analyst is different. Freudian analysts usually are perceived as, and probably they are, severe and strictly separating profession from persona, and thus emphasizing that the persona stays strictly neutral and stranger. I know that a woman analyst, a psychoanalyst in Germany, met one of her analysts on a Sunday in a park and said, oh, you have an analysis with me. Have a nice day. That was it. Well, the other two analysts, foreign analysts meet, and the one says, well, hello, have a nice day, and the other one thinks, what did you want to say with that? Of course, there is a reason to that in Freudian analysis, because transference issues are considered as being absolutely conditional, whereas we have already in your setting a much more personal and much more dialogue aspect. Now, that also exposes us. And sometimes one possibility of defense is if the analyst wants to know more about us than about himself. So we have to be very careful not to overlook mechanisms of defense. And that usually Freudians can do better than we. Because when we are involved personally, then sometimes we disregard a little bit the technical aspects. The same issue is, if we analyze dreams, I tend really to emphasize, so what does the dream suggest, in which direction should we be open to develop? Not necessarily want to develop, because if you want to do something deliberately, it's an ego action. Whereas the dream opens some ways, but I think the concrete aspect, and by that also the question of in which way maybe our personal adaptation, and by that the persona should be changed, is something which should be discussed along with the pure symbolic analysis of the dream. Now, there is of course also the seduction by the professional persona, and as I told you in that example where the marriage was transformed into a permanent analysis, there's a nice saying, and it has something true. In schools, the most difficult children are the so-called P children. What are P children? Children they are sons and daughters of psychologists, psychiatrists, pediatricians, policemen, priests, pastors, and politicians. All these professions are in danger to identify with the persona. Psychologists, pediatricians, pedagogues, psychiatrists, policemen, pastors, priests, and politicians. So P children are, when you're teaching in part-time, be aware of them. You know where the difference comes from. So all children are, now we have it, all children are difficult. Children of parents are the most difficult.
We have a term, the PKs in the United States for preacher's kids.
Yeah, yeah.
You could just kind of
add it, yeah. But I think the best thing is the parents' term. Yeah.
I remember getting in a discussion one time with several women who had been married to doctors.
Yeah.
And they had learned in their professional practice never to show emotions that were not appropriate.
Really?
And so it was the wives who got angry and the doctors did not.
Now, one shameful taboo, and I think it's really very often taboo, is why do we charge for what we do? Because we are just being nice to people, we are helpful, and they have to pay. That's, in a way, it's terrible.
Uh-huh.
Now, that's really an issue which concerns me or occupies me. And I discussed it with my former analyst, and I discussed it with Guggenbühl, who was doing supervision. And Guggenbühl said something, as he likes very often to say, something quite, not paradoxical, but a little bit shocking. He says, well, that's a part of prostitution in our business. You don't like it. My analyst didn't believe it. And one only could say, well, what do we have against prostitution? Well, that was his answer. And my analyst was absolutely shocked. And nobody on the service of the self. Now, how would you react? How? You know, same thing in a way. Sometimes strikes me when going to a restaurant, not an American restaurant, because that's a very formal. said this morning, in Europe, that, and that's a useful tip I gave to you. When you come to a European restaurant, you just go to the table you want to, unless it's occupied, of course. But here, wait to be seated. All empty tables, but you have to wait. Now your table is ready. Nothing is ready. But coming back to the prostitution aspect, you are fed by maybe a female cook or female servant or female, she owns the restaurant. There's two things. Something motherly to you. She feeds you, which is normal. Why do you have to pay her? And why would people have to pay us for something which is natural? We help them. How would you? Now, really, that's a real question. Because teachers always ask fake questions and real questions. Now, that's a real question. How would you justify as a being analyst that being nice, listening, I mean, it's not always so difficult, trying to understand the dreams, hearing interesting stories. What? It's a fantastic profession. Why should they pay you? Should pay them. Yeah. Yep.
You know, I could save money by buying food at grocery store and making it at home, but if I go to a restaurant, I'm enjoying food, but I'm also helping them make a living.
Yeah.
And this is true for almost any kind of interaction, which is, some people feel this more acutely, which is why they won't go to the large bookstores or the large grocery stores, or the community.
Mm-hmm. I think that's.
There's a social exchange, so it's not that I'm paying you money, but I'm helping. You know, I'm getting something from you. I'm helping you.
Yeah, I think that's a very rational, but a good.
It's a rationalization of an emotional insight.
Exactly.
Into the community that we're part of.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right, because in my counseling, of course, I was paid by the state. So it was, and in a way still, for someone, it is completely free of charge. And that avoided conflict for me. But that also raised the question for me. And Freud insists that the patient has to pay, because he has to contribute. That's okay. But that does not solve the fact that for being nice or being helpful, you want to be paid.
Well, I'm just going to get up and I'm looking here. I never feel like I'm just being nice when I'm in there. I mean, you're coming at it from a really different perspective of myself. I feel that I'm being very hard worker. I mean, you said yesterday that usually when people come, they're suffering, or they're wounded, or sad, or something terrible has happened. Mm-hmm. And the idea
being nice and maybe the persona, but one could put it differently. And that's another thing which I absolutely agree with Hume said. You do good analysis when you are involved. I can work hours and hours, and I might be tired. I usually am tired in the evening, but I'm stimulated. So. And when I'm completely worn out, the interchange wasn't so good. I emphasize now on that aspect, which in a way to me you could replace being nice by being helpful, and that implies work.
As someone who's not an analyst, your question has raised kind of another question for me. I think we're very used to paying for services, and you know, teachers provide some of the same kind of thing. One question that comes up for me is, why is it that teachers are paid what they're paid and analysts are paid what they're paid? Because that's quite different, and so why is there so much more, you know, I guess, value put on what the analyst does than what the teacher does in terms of money?
I was like, when like analysts will often like would choose to go to school and get that training anyways, that's something, you know, I'm very interested in. So I like that idea of, I really like the metaphor of mild prostitution, where we all have a body and we all do something with our body to get money.
It's true.
I like that idea that every, like, 1 hour of work is like work, an hour of work, you know, no matter what you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
One distinction that I'm not sure it's right, or what often in my field is when the question comes up in clergy, the answer is often, like everyone else, I need to be paid for my time. But in fact, my concern and my engagement, not for sure. And if in fact I cannot connect with someone I'm doing counseling, but I refer them to someone else, that I think keeps that tension on. If in fact you don't have that connection, it's not spontaneous, it's not real, it's not an integrity relationship, then the professional ethic says you must refer. And I think that's how you keep probably prostitution, but at least it's good-hearted. but I think it's always a tension. But I think the thing is, what's actually for sale?
Yes, please.
When I was a teenager, I went to a college, although I didn't think of it as college. I wanted to pursue my education. And I looked at the world and said, no, the world does not respect artists in terms of money. Mm-hmm. If you want to be poor or crazy, you can get into that field. Yeah. If that idea doesn't strike you that well, so I went into the military and I got a GI Bill, went to school, and I went to a school called Art Center. And I consciously made the decision, I'm going to prostitute the skills that I have.
Yeah.
Because in this one field, they don't pay me.
Yeah.
So, you know, in terms of time, it sort of makes sense. And right now I have a dichotomy. I do part-time teaching. And I have a one-month gig at Microsoft. And I get about the same amount per hour. And I was thinking, you know, if I didn't really love my art, photography art, and enjoy the teaching process, I think I like working at Microsoft better, because I don't have to take that home.
Mm-hmm. And
you work
yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
You're never
you
off.
Absolutely.
You don't get paid for that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I must be good that I think I feel shame when I ask too much money from my students. I'm private.
Yeah.
And so I have to just ask according to what their income is.
Yeah.
I can't do it any other way.
Yeah. You're right. It's the best thing. No.
What kind of shame that is? But
no, that's not. Yeah. No. You know, I don't have an answer to the question. But when you were talking, you know, for instance, as when you're employed as a priest or as a teacher or as a counselor, then the problem is not raised. But think of the situation: somebody's in grief, comes to the priest, and the priest says, "Okay, I give you spiritual help now. $100, please." That aspect to the extreme bothers me.
Well, isn't that why we have our social structure set up the way it is to put sort of indirections between us and the transactions,
mm-hmm.
and that you're confronted more directly when you're working one to one.
Yeah, exactly.
But all of us are in the very same situation.
Yeah.
absolutely.
We all put ourselves into, I shouldn't say all, because not everyone works for employment for money, but a large portion of us do, and we're all in a situation of, we're very fortunate doing a line of work where we do get intrinsic value for ourselves out of the work we do. Professional pride, sometimes we're in a line of work where, hey, I do that anyway, whether they pay me or not.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody's so fortunate to be in a line of work. Sometimes it really is just line of work.
Yeah, absolutely.
But if you're a counselor being paid by the government, you're still being paid by us.
Of course.
Taxes.
Yeah.
We're all pooling our money and paying you.
Yeah.
If you're a teacher, we're pooling our money and paying you.
Absolutely.
But there are these indirect...
Absolutely, and that's why you could...
Society,
yeah.
The socialist structure has mediated the
absolutely.
Transaction versus one-to-one service.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it becomes much... It's the fact that it's become personal and it has circumvented the social...
I don't want to insist too much on it, but I think it's very true. And now if we think of former societies where the ties were much closer, that problem wasn't raised, but these societies did not need psychotherapy because you were so much in that structure that literally nothing could help you. If your parents would die, somebody else would immediately take care of you. And that's why a certain individualization, but also alienation, has taken place, so that the question of who takes care of you when you are in need or you want to grow personally, whatever, becomes something professional.
Well, sometimes, but also people who are
of course, that's the shadow of that. Yeah, and that's again the positive side. Yeah.
But in the primitive societies, wasn't the shaman more integrated?
The shadow?
The shaman.
Oh, yeah.
More integrated into the community.
Yeah.
And so that was a regular part of it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, there's another way of thinking about this, and I kind of blurted out my first response, which is, obviously I take great satisfaction from what I do, and I have very little shame about charging for it. Another way that I think about it is that is what money symbolizes, and I think that Deborah was getting at that to a large extent about the exchange, but there's another way. I mean, the symbolism is so multi-textured and multi-layered, but just like at times, if there's not an exchange of money, it's almost propagating a fantasy that I have no needs. It's sort of like I'm the omnipotent mother.
Yeah, absolutely.
That mother who is always constantly available with no frustration and impingements, but the only way the child grows up is to begin to be having to deal with their omnipotence and beginning to recognize that mother does have needs, the mother is a separate other person, and to be able to tolerate frustration.
Absolutely.
And so there's a lot of symbolism around money.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So that's one of them.
Yeah. Okay, now just two more examples of that professional persona. I talked about professionalism and authenticity, and usually you have to hold the tension, but I know two interesting examples where it was not quite possible for me. One was, there was a student, a woman student. It was a very strange kind of symptom, which she openly displayed. She says she wanted to commit suicide. And that was her biggest wish, practically from adolescence or even childhood. Not connected with a depression, and not connected with a openly schizophrenic problem. But to be taken serious. And she managed to almost blackmail, to control her parents by that. They didn't dare going to vacation anymore, and came to counseling, and that, and I tried everything was not could not be influenced in any way, until one time I got personally so, because who does not have maybe some experiences or fantasies of suicide, I really lost my temper, and it was clear. I did not say but I openly got, and honestly got, and almost uncontrollably got emotional. The effect was, she was completely scared. I won't do it, I won't do it anymore, but I don't come anymore. So that was something, you know, it's sometimes good not to emphasize the persona, but to let emotion come through. The other example was the one and only real didactic success I had, and that was not therapeutical, but in a teaching context. In my former job at the Institute of Applied Psychology, I had to teach policemen. To give them courses, because they sometimes have a little tendency to become a little bit really aggressive. And psychologists are there not to, to tell them that they shouldn't do that. Now, I had different groups, and we did role-playing, and I liked that very much, and I went on with them on patrol. Well, that's another story, but I will tell that. But now, I had a group of detectives, and they didn't like that they had to come to that psychological course, and I was quite young back then. And then I taught my little story. And then one was asking, now, you, if you were faced with a demonstration, and somebody of these demonstrants would spit at you and would say, you damn Nazi, and so on, so on, so on. What would you do?
Yes.
And I said, well, I can't answer as a psychologist, but only as a human being. I would slap this person on the face. Okay, that was first act. Second act. I was helping out the organization Terre des Hommes on an exhibition once, and two couples came to me, and one was recognizing me and was one of these detectives. And he said, well, recently I thought of you. I had to take care of somebody who was completely drunk in a restaurant in the so-called Niederdorf, part of Zurich, you know. And he was really... no. Well, we finished too early. And he was really nasty with me, and he was aggressive and everything. And in that moment, I thought, well, Malin would slap his face, but I don't. Okay, now, just before lunch, that you get some nice impression, and we will talk after lunch about beauty. I will try to show you, in case it works, a part of the Swiss Beauty Contest. Well, it was maybe 2 years ago, because that happens every year. And you see first a short sequence where these girls are in a determined choreography going down the stairs, and each one is trying to be the more beautiful than the other one. It's a fairy tale. And then you see the final moment, there's always one is watered away, and then there are two, and one is the one. And then really she is the princess. And she's getting led up the stairs, and everything is really as beautiful as it only can be in a highly democratic society as in Switzerland. The shadow of democratic societies is really royalism. So that we will do, and then we will talk about beauty, and we will talk about what we will have seen. Okay, now.
I feel awkward about doing this, but we were talking earlier about you know, that nice person that we go around trying to be, and I maybe some time ago, and my impulse was just to make the ugliest, the warts, the clawing at the face, the two sides going of things going on. And so anyway, I don't know what I was doing exactly, except it felt right to just make it as ugly as I possibly could. And the only, I don't understand exactly why yet, but I think it has something to do with just trying to respond to that nice person, you know, always brought up as a nice person, a good persona, you know, always being there for people and doing the right things, blah, 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 being responsible and all that. But part of me is just, you know, clawing away at myself. So, anyway.
Being nice, being beautiful is probably not on the same level, but it has some connections. And we start with that little part of that beauty contest. And I said, if possible, we should see behind the commercialized, industrialized, almost caricature way of that way of dealing with our society. Also, what's symbolic or what's of the power behind it. And it means something, I think there are two aspects who fit into these contests. One, that, and we saw that she's getting a crown, she is a princess. Now, in every fairy tale, the princess is beautiful. Sleeping Beauty. Snow White, the big problem comes that she is more beautiful than her stepmother. So beauty is something which is connected with the notion of prince, and more princess, and something which is also typical that after the princess is elected, she is not continuously princess, because after 1 year, it's finished. And that fits in the archetype of the king. As soon as the king, now that's a different archetype from the prince, but it's the and the queen, but it's in a way the development, the prince eventually develops into a king and the princess into a queen. But when the king is not healthy anymore, and that was very crucial in some societies, he not only has to be replaced, he has to be killed. And that's why, and something is interesting, no? Medical conditions have to be legally kept a secret, except for politicians. The health of politicians is not a taboo. And that is because the politician has to be, as some sort of secular representative of the king, he has to be healthy. Because if he isn't healthy, it affects the whole community. So that periodicity, now not on the aspect of health, but health and beauty are interconnected, is in that sense consistent that it's a defined period of time, and then there's the next one, and there's the next one, and there's the next one. It's very mechanical, it's very stupid in a way, I agree, but it is not completely exempt of symbolic, archetypal background aspects which add to the fascination, even or maybe especially in a so-called democratic society. Now, the second aspect of beauty being connected with health and youth and something prosperous, something spring-like, is a Greek notion. And that's, I have to tell, to stay a little bit with it. It's called the notion kalos katados. I write it here.
Is it the bottom of the Broadway television?
Oh, yes. I'm so happy that once in my schooling learned to write Greek, and I want to show you that I can.
Yeah.
One of the ministers with whom I had my religious education said,
Everything you ever learned, you will be able to use once.
That's true.
I hope I still make it. It's not only to show that I ended it, but it's also important. Kalos means beautiful. Agathos means good. And that K is an abbreviation for Kai. So, the Greek ideal is beautiful and good. But it has merged because originally the K would be Kai. But the ideal of beauty, as it has been translated from the Greek myth, from the culture, is to be beautiful and good. And since it has merged, I think archetypally it is connected that in a way we identify in fairy tales, in myth, think of the Greek heroes, of the statues of Greek heroes, of statues of Greek goddesses, that the good is intimately connected, the beautiful is intimately connected with the good, the morally good.
But also, Old English or Middle English, word is, that is the source, it's something like failing, and it's the source of whole, pale, health, healthy, and holy.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why, you know, in this, I'd say, ridiculous forms, these symbolic archetypal aspects shine through, and in order to understand it, and in order to understand also the strange or the general forms we are witnessing it, should be connected with that background. Since, you know, beauty is not so much a reality, but it's an idea. And striving for an idea in whatever context is also something archetypal. So in a way, there are two extremes which are dangerous. One is to naively identify, as we have seen it now with in that context, beauty with wholeness. And it's not so complicated. Because you said, there's a research that, and I completely agree with you, that beautiful people are not happier. They are, however, more successful in the society, but they are not happier. And that has to do with something else, which I've... No, I'm so glad I found it out, because it certainly has been found out a million times, but I haven't read it. Any ideal only stays an ideal until you have reached it. For instance, if I only had, if I only were, and for instance, if I only got that partner, if I only would be wealthy, if I only had that house, if I only had that car, whatever. Now, I tell you something. The moment you have it, very soon it gets normal. And that's one of the difficulties in a stable relationship. It's only really terrible as long as you don't have it. As soon as you are in it, you see, you're confronted with shadow aspects. I told you I like very much to eat, and I like very much to drink good wine. Now there is something that, and that's only true for wine, but for everything. With rising quality, the price is not rising parallelly but exponentially. So some people really want to have the most expensive wine, and so the ideal of wine. So Dionysos and whatever you project on. Okay, now, you drink wine.
taste it. You know, that's a whole ceremony in Europe. Mm-hmm. Don't just... No, but that's really a big ceremony. I mean, it's a little bit of plum, a little bit of cherry, a little bit of whatever. Whatever. Now you drink it while eating. Finish. It's quite a nice wine. And even if it costs extremely much, you are, as soon as you have it, you get used to it, and you strike for another idea. And that's probably the reason why once you are appointed beauty queen, you don't have any idea anymore. So you really have to grow inwards, and that's a difficult moment. To change the really extrovert search for the ideal of beauty, maybe behind, unconsciously, Carlos Cagatos, becoming whole, and then you think, no, instead of becoming whole, you experience that you're shallow. So if not at the same time as the kalos, you develop the agathos, the good qualities which we would compare with individuation, then you experience unhappiness. And I think something which is very important, that acting out the search for the ideal in outer aspects is a big threat to individuation. It's always projected on the outside. Instead of appreciating what you have and being happy with it. And that's what has to do with that probably with society. I don't quite agree with you that you are completely at the mercy of society. We have the possibility of a certain degree going our own way, but as Jung says, individuation means loneliness. And if you don't want to pay the price for certain loneliness, or at least the faculty of in certain moments staying alone, then we are at the mercy of collective life.
This might really fascinating because my husband died. He committed suicide. I helped him. And the next few years, I experienced, I decided that the thing to do was to go, feel the feelings.
Yes, yep.
And what I'm struggling with now is my best friend's husband died, ironically, of the same disease. And I'm sort of trying to help, but she's doing it so incredibly differently that I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But my thing was to feel the feelings. It was terrible, terribly terrible. And then there was the loneliness, and I decided, okay, I'll try to make aloneness instead of loneliness.
Yes.
I'll try to transform that.
Yes.
But the ironic thing was that, and this is why I'm so interested in the persona thing, because I said to my best friend, I am no longer the same person. I am no longer the same. And she's the one now who's facing the same issue. And I was adamant about not being the same person. Don't expect the same thing of me. I'm different. Now, my question then was, do you become different? Or do you just give up the persona? Or I don't know. I don't know. And so I'm just at a loss of how to help her. But I think what you said, you just be with her. And her privacy, let her do it her own way. But the persona, it's sort of, I still am left with the question, well, who the hell am I?
Sorry?
I'm still left with the sort of question of who the hell am I?
Yeah. But the short answer to your question, being able give up the persona means you have changed.
I don't think so.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, if the persona is shattered, then it depends whether you have that the sort of regressive restoration of the persona, as Jung says. But being able to renounce it, to give it up, means that you have changed. You don't cling to it anymore. And that's an important aspect, I would say, of growth and of integration.
I think that, I mean, translate that into, let's say, a creative process. You give birth to something, and then you create that, and it's finished, and you're moving on. There's a part of me that would like to know what the end result of the next phase would look like, because that would be more comfortable. But you have to just kind of sit with it.
Yes.
You can't know. Otherwise, it's not an adventure. It's not a creative process.
Is it always lonely?
Yes. Especially after having completed something, there's this kind of down phase. And in that phase, there's a great tendency. In my younger days, I used to do drugs. That was a mistake. And I don't do that anymore because I know that it doesn't lead to increased. You no longer have a harmonious sort of cycle. It gets really jagged, so I don't do that. But there's still a down point that you have to sit with myself, for yourself. But you can't change.
When I lived in Zurich, I lived with Jung's daughter, who told me a story about her father. His daughter's husband died at an early age. Jung said to her, "Whenever someone close to you dies, the gates of heaven open, and you should watch very closely." And she told me this story because when I was living with her, my former husband died, so we had that bond. I think being that close to death is really a new initiation by the death archetype, and that it requires an inner life that you didn't have access to before, and a lot comes through that you never saw. You imply that you will see what you haven't seen before. When the gates of heaven are open. And of course, that's something no one else can do for you.
No. No. No.
You're on your own.
No. Absolutely. But I think there's a big distinction between loneliness and loneliness. The big issue is your initiation is an experience where you're alone. But that does not mean you're lonely. And on the other hand, you can be with people and feel very lonely. And the worst loneliness is living in a relationship where you feel lonely. That's terrible. And that can happen. Okay, now from that stage, I would invite you to go back now to the almost something like synonymous of accepting himself. He seeks to be cured first by one doctor and then by another, now by such and such a method or in such and such circumstances, irrespective of any serious cooperation on his own part. Now, no one can be washed without getting wet. Without the most perfect goodwill and the absolutely serious intention of the patient, no recovery is possible. That's one thing, but then it crossed my mind also, especially with what you have said, that you're working with anorectic patients, maybe, or I wouldn't say probably, women are more apt for that too. That work. Women are better apt for that work. And you also, and we discussed this morning, you have to have inner affinity to eating disorders in order to treat them. Now, I'm afraid I love too much to eat and I love too much to cook, so I can't understand it. I mean, we talk of persona of the
animals.
Sorry?
I mean, that's my eating disorder.
nothing too much to do.
Okay, now that's good news of this morning. So I'll dare three things. Yeah, I said, well, I like three. yes. Yeah, we had an example of that yesterday.
Yeah, we did it.
I was actually sympathetic with you. You're eating these small almonds, and as if, well, better some small almonds than no beer.
No, we
can we take a break and sort of open up?
Of course, yep. Yes, please.
I actually had quite a few reflections about the last part of your talk.
Yes.
And it seemed to me there were some transitional images between the sort of the everyday appearance and the demonic.
Yeah.
So there were some transitional ones.
Absolutely.
When I looked at the transitional ones, they didn't look unfamiliar to me. I had encountered that sort of archetypal image myself.
Yes.
That kind of a, I'll call it a character, it as it turns out, was the first encounter I had with the cyclopon.
Oh. Yeah.
And so it's an animus type of a character which has this, you know, reptilian scale or whatever, you know, sort of a, it's not demonic though, but it had some of these characteristics. And what it seemed to me with the women who were not willing to go inward, were not willing to deal with this inner world, that by rejecting that archetype in their life, it became hostile to them. Mm-hmm. And by becoming hostile, there became this polarization to, and that's what forced it into this more demonic form. And so these women are unwilling to, as you said, in and out, this demonic reaction, to go in and relate to this pump that has been activated in their psyche. These, you said, these are intelligent women, very intelligent women. This is they have the capacity, and it's been activated, but they aren't willing to empathize with it and to follow and trust that part and go inward with it, and therefore this hostility comes back from it, and then it turns into this demonic force, which is so destructive and eats them up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Now, I think diagnosis is absolutely as you say. Now, what would be the possibility of therapeutic intervention with that state in which you name, I think, and you're completely right, Chikopratio Pompos, when he leads you. Mm-hmm. But how can you in actual work connect with that feeling?
And that's I'm not a therapist, so I don't really know how you would deal with that. I just know from my own experience that the first time I encountered this, it wasn't in it. There was no context of hostility. There was a context of trust and empathy. Yeah. So it never arose as a problem for me. I don't know if these women, being as intelligent as they are, if an intellectual explanation of what this is might be possible or not. Or,
Can I make a request?
Yeah.
Could we perhaps show those last two transparencies again? I think it would be helpful to see the pictures. Can we do that? Yeah.
You want to see all of them again?
The two women. Since we're spending a lot of time on them, it would be nice to sort of refresh.
Yeah, but all the transparent the whole theory. Well, you know.
Would that be okay?
This is the first, and then that what you refer to probably getting up in that transitional state? Would you see that as still the transition?
Well, it was more clear to me in the second.
Let me just for those who haven't seen it, show me the eye. And this one. So that's the first.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.